It's recorded up until 5 o'clock or so. But then Nima and I often hang around. We call it hallway chat. The recording gets turned off and we can just talk more informally about things that maybe are going through your head. Okay, Jill, let's do the next slide. So just a couple of announcements. First of all, I know a couple of announcements. The pandemic is of course raging and next slide, please, Jill. Next slide. Nope. You skipped there. Okay.
I don't know what's doing. Okay.
Stop. Yeah. So during this year, we will have business, or, you know, regular business to conduct. Okay. Some meetings will be dedicated to pandemic related stuff. Sometimes we'll have meetings where only part of the floor time is for that. So let me just step through a couple of things that will be coming down the pike this year. So in June, we looked at the vet school's RTE cap proposal. That'll come up pretty early in the day. The tenure track project has actually been going on for 2 years. The academic freedom professional status of the faculty committee has gone through virtually every little protocol and procedure that hangs off the tenure track from when you're hired to when you're promoted. And we want to renovate a lot of things there. So that's going to come up. There's also ongoing work with RTE faculty. This work got kind of nixed early in the year because of the pandemic, but we want to continue that, looking at the various procedures associated with RTE faculty and make some improvements. And something Nima and I have really wanted to work on, it has to do with committee structure, committee size. Do we have the right alignment of committees? How do they interact with the Senate and so on? So that's sort of it. Let me just pause right here. And if you have any other topics, sort of not regular business topics, so to speak, that you think we should cover, feel free to raise your hand now or to send us email in the near future, or as the ideas come to your desk of things that that deserve Senate attention. So question? Okay, so I see one good, does RTE emeritus status and perks get discussed by the Senate? Just a review of that, we passed a resolution in the late fall giving certain RTE title holders the option of getting emeritus status upon retirement. That was step one in the approval process. It has to go to the provost and then the trustees. At the provost/dean level, we have to work out a few more details about the perks associated with becoming emeritus. So I would sort of say that under number three there, we will certainly be tracking that progress, but that sort of has left the Senate and is now working its way through the other layers of approval. Okay. But again, the Senate is for handling any kind of problems that you think the faculty should consider. And we do like hearing from you. The UFC, the University Faculty Committee, sets the agenda. And if you have an idea, it'll be discussed in the UFC. If you have resolutions, we also, they'll find their way to the UFC and onto the Senate floor. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So before we get to the pandemic things, we want to pick up on the anti-racism initiative. What is it? And Nima and I have some general comments we'd like to make about this. Next slide. So here are the key, the reference points, the things that are prompting this. Recall sort of in the middle of June, we passed a resolution on combating racism prompted by national events. And when we talked about that, there's an undercurrent in the Senate that, resolutions are fine, words are fine, but we really want to do something. Well, now we have a chance to actually do something, okay? And over the summer, an organization called Do Better Cornell, and actually that's the wrong URL, it's .com, student-led, it's sort of a clearinghouse for student ideas, petitions are reported there and so on. I've met with the individual who sort of runs Do Better Cornell, and we will be hearing from them at the next Senate meeting, most likely. And that activity, the an urging to actually make concrete changes here to campus life, this group has really sent forward excellent ideas for full consideration. The president picked up on that and sent everybody a message on July 15th. It's called Additional Actions to Create a More Just and Equitable Cornell. So we just want to give you a very brief preview here and have some discussion, but much more later. But we feel that it's very important to begin thinking about this now. So let's go to the next slide, Jill. Back, you have a quick thing, you want to back up one. There we go. So there are 5 points in the president's message. Five, you can think of them in different ways, to-do items, things for us to think about and then act on. And we thought we'd step through these 5 things. Nima and I have worked on some of these things. Again, we're trying to set the stage for a productive Senate meeting on this, which will probably be our next meeting. And one of the items on the list is the creation of some kind of center that would focus on anti-racism scholarship and how it can be amplified on campus. And Nima has spent time talking to directors of, let's just call them nearby institutes and centers and programs, trying to get a feel for the lay of the land so that we can propose something effective to the president. So Nima, how about a little bit of background?
Thanks, Charlie. As I think everybody knows, there's a significant group of faculty on campus, as well as centers that have been looking at, that have been sort of at the forefront of scholarship around questions of race and equity. And we've been talking to them, you know, a series of conversations to understand how, you know, how I guess the politics of all this worked and works on campus. And we've also been collecting information on various task forces and initiatives that the university has run over the years to make change happen. And then as part of that, of course, is what keeps falling through the cracks and what doesn't get doesn't begin to happen. So it includes amplifying all the existing sort of scholarship resources, all of these that exist on campus. And we've reached out to a number of people. And the hope is that we will build a process that keeps what's happening on campus now at the core to begin to explore what should come next. The question of resources is of course key, and Charlie is having that conversation right now with university leadership. So that's the first piece, and I think the biggest piece, and it's on us as the faculty to really begin to imagine what this new center will be. So it's wide open, and just to reiterate what Charlie said, you know, we just want to prime the conversation, start the conversation, and then devote an entire session, I think, of the Senate to really, of a Senate meeting to really beginning to think about this. We also will have another form of sort of a shorter lived sort of committee that will actually work through the nuts and bolts of the whole piece. So that's point number one. The second piece is about thinking through President Pollack's message, talked about thinking through a core required educational requirement for students and where that would be. So lots of questions come up. We have one model, which is the freshman writing seminars. Do we offer, you know, a variety of courses? So there are many, many questions around this issue that we'll have to explore as in the Senate and make a recommendation to university leadership. That's the second piece. The third piece is to actually start. So just going back to point two, I'm kind of keeping an eye on chat. Certain colleges have put into place already what they call diversity requirements. So this is something that various parts of university, various departments, various colleges have started to take taken to their own hands. The President Pollock would like something that's really university-wide, and that was something that various faculty members had also expressed an interest in. So that's number two. The third piece is to start a systematic review of all departments and units of the curriculum of the university to consider these questions of diversity, race, bias, equity, justice, to understand where we are falling short and how we can really begin to change what we teach. So that's the third part. The fourth big initiative was really thinking through a mandated program for re-educating ourselves, if we want to use that language. It's a training program, it's learning programs, it's about us having serious conversations about how we change what we do with our students, with our graduate students, in our research labs, and so on. So that's the fourth bit. The fifth is really, in that email, there is mention of a themed semester. With the pandemic, it's hard for us to think about this right now. So Charlie and I, in pulling together various pieces, of previous work that's happened, of work that's ongoing at the university, of sort of the big gaps that we see, we've really focused on points 1 through 4. Now, the idea today was to have, I don't know, Charlie, how many minutes, 5, 10 minutes, something like that, to just collect from all of you questions, comments, suggestions, so that we, can really have a good discussion when we, at the next Senate meeting. So I'll stop there and open up for questions. Shall we just take stuff from the chat, Charlie?
Let me just sort of say, there's something that people are initially shy and raise their hand, but let me just say a couple of things. So, we have this decentralized Cornell model where the colleges do their own thing. And I'm looking at the chat, lots of colleges have already moved in this direction, and that's extremely important. And we want to understand what our colleges are doing. That's part of our learning curve here. Also we'll have some students come at the next meeting to present things, and it'd be nice to give them a synopsis of the kinds of things that are going through senators' minds when we deal with this sort of thing. Are there any raised hands, Jill? I can't.
I see one here about environmental justice. And so, yes, the questions of environmental justice has come up. And so there are, so when we're thinking about, who's at the table to have these conversations, we are, of course, going to make sure that units that are quite central to funding work on environmental justice, to education, et cetera, are included. So yes, that will happen.
So the senator from Africana has had the hand up for quite some time. Femi, do you still want to speak?
Yes, I do.
You're on.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all for your work, Charlie and Nima. But let me just say that, because this is very, very important. When the university announced this was the first intimation the faculty at Africana had about this center. And there's something amiss about that, given Africana's pivotal role on campus and 50 years of history dealing with matters of race. You should not be hearing about this in the media. And when you say you have been talking to faculty who are involved in centers, no one has talked to me as chair of Africana about this in any manner, shape, or form. And I report the faculty's position that they felt blindsided when this announcement came out. I hope going forward, we'll do a better job of talking to us in Africana and not having us hear this on the street. There are other issues in the students' demands that also touch on Africana. And as I advise my faculty, where I come from, it is said, you don't shave a person's head in their absence. So students want to talk about moving Africana library or even whatever other space. I hope the university will do us the courtesy of consulting new students don't with Africana faculty before moving on any one of those things. Thank you.
Absolutely. So, I mean, there was a list of centers and programs in the president's message, and we're working on expanding that and to really have a very broad engagement of all the individuals who run related programs, including, of course, yours. I can promise you that going forward, we will absolutely engage Africana, the Africana Center Research Center. So.
Yeah, I just want to second that, Femi. I mean, it's not, I think what happened, there was a lot of emails going back and forth. And then as always with everything that's happening, that's inadvertent. So my apologies. And yes, Africana always, you know, is critical and is at the very center of anything, of any move that we have to make moving forward.
Other hands, Sarah.
Harold Hodes.
Yep, that's me. So the new distribution requirements for the College of Arts and Sciences involved one of the 10 categories being human difference or social difference. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I would think that within the College of Arts and Sciences, that would be a natural home for an educational requirement on racism, bias, and equity. In fact, you might say to some extent, it constitutes an educational requirement, at least one that's highly relevant to issues about racism, bias, and equity. That's it.
Thank you. Sarah?
Thank you. I in no way wish to denigrate what's happening at all. I think it's really important. I'd just like to draw your attention to the fact that over the last 7 years, we've had absolutely no improvement in the gender inequity in faculty salaries on this campus. So it still stands at, I believe, 8%, even according to official statistics. So that means essentially female faculty are working 1 year in 10 for free. I really urge you to think about equity in the broadest possible sense and to not accept what I've been told, which is over the coming years, we will certainly think about that. I've only been on this campus for 7 years, but I can say over the last 7 years, absolutely no progress has been made on this issue. So it means in my seven, you know, I look forward to working my free year very soon.
Charlie, let me just step in for a moment. I'm watching the chat. Just so all of us, all of you on the call with us realize, Charlie and I saw the president's letter literally minutes before it went out, just a little bit time before it went out. So part of our effort, not minutes, maybe some hours, part of our effort was to bring in units and our colleagues and faculty who actually work on these issues. Right? It isn't as if this work hasn't been happening on campus, as so many of you who are active on chat recognize. And so part of our huge effort has been to make sure that we are all taken into consideration, that our work is actually forefronted, and that any kind of a center that we're going to be, that the university is going to support and would like to support and like to see happen, that it takes this into account. So what I think my wish is that we'll be able to move forwards. It's taken us some time to actually get even an initial list in people's view, and we want to make sure that the list is as inclusive as possible. And we would love your input on making that list inclusive. There is no intention of excluding anybody or of playing any sort of favorites. So that's the first point I want to make in general response to, I think, a lot of the issues on chat. We're trying to be completely transparent. We want to be, we will be completely transparent in terms of how we want to organize the process by which we as a faculty will imagine what this new center will be. So that's the second point. So I wanted to sort of, you know, to make that sort of quite clear as well. There's also complaints that the only invitation that some of you received was at 1 p.m. today. Yes, that's me sending the email at 1 p.m. today, because this wasn't actually on the agenda. This is an emergency Senate meeting that was called. We've been working to put a list of centers together. We called the Senate meeting. It's primarily focused on reopening, because that's the challenge that we face right now today. And Charlie and I wanted very much to give everybody an update. So that 1 o'clock email that everybody received is from a draft list of centers that we're still putting together. So like I said, it's a draft list. If you didn't receive an email at 1 p.m. about your unit being on some sort of draft list, please send us an email, Charlie and myself, copy Jill. She keeps us on track, and we will add it to that list. So the idea here is to have a transparent process, and everybody needs to join us in making that happen. If we make a mistake, let us know, and we will change it.
We have time for one more question. Joni has her hand up.
Thanks. I'll wait. Thank you.
Okay, you're muted. Okay, go on.
No, I don't want to, can you hear me? I don't want to say my question now.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
All right, very good. Okay, so as I said at the beginning, this is just a heads up to get us all thinking about this very important topic, a very challenging to-do list for the Senate, and we'll be picking this up at the next meeting. Okay, Jill, let's go on to the next slide. Yeah, so now we want to turn to questions that concern the reopening of the campus for the fall. And a reminder that there's a town hall tomorrow, I believe 4 to 5, that run by the provost and others who lead the various implementation teams. So one way of thinking about the upcoming conversation that we'll have here is simply to set the stage for that. They collect questions in advance, and I told them that after this meeting, we'll try to crystallize some of the important ones from the group. To make sure they get considered tomorrow. So again, we all are very busy. We live in our departments. You maybe know a little bit about what's going on in your college, but what about that other college? So it is a great value in having these free-form discussions where we can see what the other person sees. So maybe the high-level question here is, what does F20 preparation look like in your unit? What have been some of the issues, the controversies, the things that are making you concerned, and so on? So just a little bit of setting the stage for that. Next slide, please, Jill. So one concern has to do with the actual course lineup. And here are some stats that I got hold of earlier today that I wanted to share with you. So just a little bit. There, we have a webpage that identifies the 8 implementation committees, who's on them. You can post comments on these things. I sit in on a weekly meeting where the implementation heads swap notes, concerns, and so on. And there's a lot going on, tremendous numbers of interconnections, and so on. But I thought this would be a good way to begin, because we're all now thinking real hard about that first day of class. What is it going to look like? What does the courses of study book look like to students? As near as I can make out, there is the following timeline: that this Friday will be published the complete lineup of all courses that are offered, together with their modality, you know, online, hybrid, et cetera. Then early next week, possibly on Monday, the time and place of the offerings will be published. And then, I guess sort of towards the end of next week, students will be able to then enter into the pre-registration process. All that's down the road, but I wanted to share with you these statistics because there have been various surveys done over the summer about faculty inclinations and so on. So on the top table, you see four different types of classes. And in one column is the number of courses and the percent of courses that have some in-person component. And then complementing that are the courses that are all online. So you can see these four broad classifications of types of classes, okay, and the percents, okay? Down below, same sort of pairing, only now broken out by the level of the course, from freshman on up to PhD level. And you can look at the, I highlighted in red the key percents, okay? So that gives you an idea of how things are now beginning to fall out. I think early in the summer, there was a survey and a faculty about your inclinations. And it was a third, a third, a third. A third said, I'm online, period. A third said, you know, I'm probably gonna do in person. And then that middle third that was fuzzy, saying basically it would depend on the safety of the teaching environment that'll pivot my decision. So these percents are lower. I think overall things have gotten worse nationally and there's more nervousness, there's more uncertainty. And whatever. So anyway, here are these percents, and maybe that will prompt you to think about or share a comment based on your home unit. Then I have just one more slide where I, Jill, next slide. Here are, back up, you have a sticky button or something there. Here are six questions that I've heard a lot. Some have been posted on our website, others you just sort of hear a lot, and let me just sort of again step through them. This isn't by any means exhaustive. What I'm trying to do here is just trigger your thinking so that you can share some insights. So one is the behavioral compact, which I believe is going to be released this afternoon, if I'm correct. And I also believe there's some plan about how it's going to be enforced. People have thought about this a lot. It's a very frequent question. So that's forthcoming, and I believe it's this afternoon. Then the number two is really the communication thing. And I think this is very widespread. I hear this all the time, which is the communication has not been optimal. A sample thing is like if a mass mailing goes out to students, why can't the faculty simply be CC'd? And I know we have overflowing inboxes, but it seems to me this is a very low overhead, easy thing to do. When that doesn't happen, here's the consequences. Say like go back last week about the quarantine announcement that goes to students. A student immediately gets on the phone to their advisor. The advisor doesn't know anything about it. The advisor feels stupid. The student begins to wonder, how come the faculty don't know about this? And on both sides, there's a devaluation of confidence, okay? So we have to improve the way things are communicated to the constituencies. And I hope we can make some progress on that. Then the latest thing, the modified quarantine policy, there are issues about fairness that only more affluent students can find a way to get quarantined and be here if you're from one of those 31 states. And then there are concerns in the county about what this means for public health with a randomized quarantine thing going on in town. Lots of concern about what happens in the dorms, okay? Usually you visit a dorm during the middle of the day, it's practically empty. Well, it's not gonna be that way when we get into the fall of the fall semester. So there's a lot of concern about that. We have great talent, faculty talent in the dorms on the West Campus. We have the House Deans on North Campus. We have faculty in residence. They're on the front line and they have an awful lot of concerns and that we should take into consideration. A month or so ago, there were the issues about the TA accommodations that faculty could teach online simply for the asking, but that a TA had to sort of ask for an accommodation. I just called over to Student Disability Services. You might recall that they are involved in the accommodation process, and they said that the numbers were quite low. They'd only dealt with about 20 TAs with this concern. The theory to cover the facts is that many departments on their own took it upon themselves to give their grad TAs choice, all right? Therefore, circumventing the need for formal SDS approval. And then finally, I should be proud of the scientific approach that's being taken, and part of that is data. And a question that's come up is what kind of visibility of when we do all this testing, when students come back, how visible will be the data? Is it just going to be folded into the Tompkins County stats or whatever? So in other words, how are we going to be informed about how things are progressing? Now, having said that, I want to mention that Peter Frazier will be joining us, will be available for questions starting at around 4 o'clock. But I think he's in charge of the modeling team, and we will, I'm sure, have questions for him. But that's it in terms of just setting the stage here. What we really want to hear from is you directly, just your insights, what is going on in your unit, and so on. So that's all I want to say. Nima, would you like to add anything to that intro?
Not really, Charlie. I think we should just take questions.
Okay, so David Delchamps.
Okay, I get the impression that you've already asked for number two to be solved, and it hasn't been solved, the CC thing. And I'm wondering, has any rationale been given to you for that? That's one question I had. Another thing I wanted to say was that we're being asked to make a lot of requests and decisions and stuff in the wrong order, in a certain sense. Like, for example, the students read about this 18 credit thing in a Cornell Daily Sun article a good 3 weeks before it ever appeared anywhere official online on the COVID page. And that's just really crazy. Students have told me, well, I'm probably not gonna come back this fall because of the 18 credit limit, or this completely monkey wrenches my plan. What am I gonna do? Can I appeal it? I don't know as a faculty member. I have to know that stuff because I'm an advisor. Okay, so that's something about the communication thing. As far as commenting on what's going on in the unit, I said we're trying to make decisions sometimes out of order. For example, we're being offered by our college extra undergraduate TA resources, but we don't know our enrollments. Why don't we know our enrollments? Because there's no schedule yet, okay? And we have to turn around these requests for extra TA support before the schedule is even out. And to me, that's crazy. You know, I don't even know if my enrollment's gonna be 19 or 57. So, you know, this has gotta get better organized, I would say. And just a throw in comment on your stats about online versus in-person. I think our department, my department at least, is right about in line with those stats, about 30, 35% in-person and the rest online. Thank you.
Thank you. So Joe Molina, who's vice president for public communications and so on, was at the University Assembly meeting that just preceded this, and I asked him that question. And so they admitted that last week was a snafu in terms of the quarantine, but you mentioned it's been a long history here, the 18 credit thing and whatever. I think they're getting the message. Joel said the following. He said that like yesterday, they sent out some very, very specific dorm thing that looked like totally irrelevant to faculty. And so he sort of said there's some comments that just really have no faculty ramifications. But I think what we have to do is say, regardless, we don't care if you flood our, there aren't gonna be that many. Just as a rule, always CC us. It just seems so simple. And so we might have to pass a resolution to make that clear, but I've been talking about this like for a month, and there just seems to be some kind of hesitation about it. It just seems like such a easy no-brainer. You are not adding to anybody's workload. And then you can be the, you know, you can either trash it when it comes into your mailbox or look at it or judge yourself whether it's relevant to how you're thinking. So I hope we get make some progress on that. I'm somewhat confident, but I don't know. Let's see. I think Mark has his hand up.
Yep.
Okay. We just had a department meeting, Mark Weisagi from Earth and Atmospheric Sciences. And one of the issues that we do have here is the IT technical support, not so much in terms of a human, but in terms of the machinery, especially not knowing what classes we're going to be teaching in room-wise. Does a university have a pool of funds where we can make requests for things such as cameras or tablets and things like this to help us with the remote teaching and so forth? Or is that an expectation that has to come out of the funds from the department or from the funds of the individual? This is going to be very, very important in terms of how we're able to give a lecture and so forth. Equipment is going to be as important as having people, IT people, help us get that all set up. Thank you.
Thanks. As I mentioned earlier, you know, it's decentralized Cornell. The colleges have different policies and whatever. Sometimes I think it sort of mirrors the national scene where you really want a stronger university-wide edict or whatever you want to say to clarify things. This actually came up the other day where the subject was off-hours use of buildings for like study groups and so on. And discussion got down into like, you know, each building is owned by a college and should they be the ones that decide things or whatever. So I think a lot of things, it should be central and universal because students don't know enough about the college structure you want to take the complexity out of their decisions and so on. Maria. Maria Nixon, you're muted. Yeah, thanks.
Apologize about that. Plant biology, Maria Gandolfo Nixon. And one of the things my faculty's worry is how we will be implementing the cleaning of the rooms, mostly for the labs, after each one of the sections are done. For example, who will be in charge of cleaning the microscopes, the space with the students will be sharing, and who will be providing for those things like wipes, etc.
Thank you. I see David Schmoyes on the call. I'm wondering if you have any insight to that particular question. The subject here is cleaning rooms, and actually this schedule, and I know I was at a meeting earlier today where it looks like we're now gonna have 30 minutes in between classes. I wonder if you could sort of talk about some of these things, cleaning, schedules, the space between classes. Can you?
I know I'm muted and I can't find the unmute button. That's my problem. Can you unmute me?
You're okay.
Am I unmuted?
No, you're fine. We can hear you.
Great. Okay. Wow, that's a complicated question. So let me start with a different question or start with the thing you had. So there will be a different meeting pattern. So between the regular 50-minute classes, there will be 20 minutes. And between some of the 75-minute classes, there'll be a longer break because essentially the way to visualize the schedule is in three-hour and 10-minute blocks. And so if you put a 75-minute one at the front and the 75-minute one at the end, that leaves 40 minutes in between. And we're going to be using a lot of those 40-minute blocks to clean classrooms. So in terms of, I mean, this has really literally just been figured out this afternoon. That prior to that, the working assumption had been that for classrooms, it would simply be cleaned by students being provided with bottles of sanitizing liquid and wipes, and that they could wipe down the arms of the chairs that they were sitting at and their tablets, and they'll still be given that. But we'll do, in addition to a deep nighttime cleaning, we're gonna do once a day in the middle of the day cleaning by the cleaning crew. Exactly how this is all going to happen is a new thing on my plate over the last 48 hours. So I can't tell you the details, but that's the spirit. Now, of course, labs are another concern, and regular cleaning crews will clean the labs as they normally would in sort of overnight cleaning, but that's very different than cleaning the equipment. And my understanding is the unit facility directors were working through with the local facility crew to work out local plans for each space relative to the equipment. So I know like CIT is thinking generically about what can be done in terms of cleaning keyboards and the like to do that, and what can be student done and that, but this is certainly there. But this gives you some range of the sense of the parameters that are in play. I guess I'm happy to answer further questions if they're more specific ones, or at least try.
Maria, again, you have your hand up? Yeah.
Yes, sorry about that. I totally understand that, but I think the fundamental question here is very expensive equipment that it shouldn't be cleaned by a student or shouldn't be cleaned by, you know, a crew person that don't know how to manage those microscopes or things that they would be extremely expensive to replace in the long run. So we need to come out with a plan to do that, because you know, putting the ice in the scopes is a factor, and cleaning them in a way that supports the equipment for a long time is also something we need to consider really careful. Thank you.
David, I know you've been very much involved in the room allocation business. Can you maybe just very, very briefly sort of talk about our class? There'll be more uniform usability of classrooms from 8 in the morning all the way around to sometime at night. Can you give us a very brief overview?
Yes. So, I mean, what we've done so far, and the units just that are getting that data early this week, and we're still working out kinks in the system, is that for the in-person classes, there now are times that are circulating amongst your department representatives for the things that are centrally scheduled, and the departmental representatives are dealing with the scheduling for the labs and the online classes. But the good news is, which is bad news in some ways, that because so few of you were willing to teach in person, the pressure to spread the length of the day is diminished, so that you won't find as many of the early morning classes and the evening classes as I was originally concerned about. But you will observe ultimately that the geographic dispersal of the classrooms will feel very different, because still in the middle of the day, we were going to be using classroom stock that was not classroom stock in there. We're still literally scouring the campus. Mary Lynn Cummings is heading the effort of coordinating on rooms and converting various reading spaces and other large spaces where we can, you know, with social distancing, accommodate even 30 people. We're short on that kind of classroom space, and so classes will be dispersed to a greater extent, and especially this now has to be coordinated with this new cleaning constraint, which will push things further. So classroom assignments will only be coming. I mean, the actual room assignments will only be coming in a couple weeks.
Okay, one more question, and then I noticed that Peter is joined us, and we'll switch to questions about the model. But Risa has her hand up.
Yeah, thank you. I really want to go, I mean, all of these questions are very, very important, and it's a little unclear to me just, you know, what we're doing with all of the concerns that we have, you know, like what kind of influence do we have on decisions that would be made. But the particular one I wanted to focus on here is that issue of equity. I mean, we just came from a discussion about, you know, taking race and racism seriously. And then when we talk about equity, you know, we have to make those connections. So, I mean, I have to say I was shocked to see a message that came from the administration saying, look, you know, if you're in a state and you can't find a place to quarantine yourself, just start online. you know, and then come later. I mean, my thought was, as a student, how am I going to figure out how to do the travel? And it's so expensive if you do it at the last minute. And if you're not a rich person, what are you going to do? I mean, the equity thing, the equity issues are massive. And I'd really like to know, you know, where things are on considering the equity issues, whether it's travel, technology, et cetera. And where are these decisions being made? And do we have, you know, sufficient faculty input through governance?
Good point. Now, the announcement last week, you know, I sensed it coming. I mean, everyone who's been watching the news, right, these 31 states, you know, it's been over the last, say, three or four weeks, you've seen this number grow, and you're wondering, what does that mean for us, right? And I guess eventually it triggered this decision, because the number of beds that are sufficient, quarantine spaces that are sufficiently close, just couldn't handle the constraint. But I guess to this question, I would have preferred that a month ago, a fork in the road be portrayed to us. Down one fork is what Ithaca College has decided, which is you just don't come if you're from one of those 31 states, which is a tough policy, but it's just based on where you're from. Whereas ours, as Risa points out, does have implications for equity implications. I wish that we could have discussed at that point, just engaged in a general discussion, but just how would you make that decision? Nima, would you like to add a couple of things here?
I wanted to add something. So, you know, yes, either it was yesterday morning or this morning, the following the op-ed that came in the Sun, I believe SCL, Student Campus Life, sent out to the, we have about 1,300 or 1,400 students in these states, right, which are on that travel advisory list. So each of them got an email asking if they need any assistance. So this is similar to the Access Fund model that the university was using during the spring. There's an application process, and you know, and through, because I sit in West Campus, I know that there's been about 400 applications. So students have put in applications, and then the university is trying to meet need. And so, you know, to figure out what that exception looks like. So I think it's a really difficult kind of situation, and I agree with you. I mean, to say to students, you know, if you have the money to come and go quarantine in a different state, it's deeply problematic. There is some recognition in asking people to file for applications if they need assistance. Is it the best thing? I don't know. I mean, I feel like we're all just, you know, trying to turn on a dime and make decisions, and it's hard. So I recognize the inequity. I'm also not clear what we could have done differently, except for what Charlie mentioned, which is to have had a continued and very open and transparent conversation. So I agree with you, Risa, but, you know, I don't know.
Okay, thank you. So let's now switch. Peter Frazier is here. Peter, again, leads the modeling team, and they produced a report back in, now I'm losing track of months. and then a few weeks after that, there was an update, which is of all this is online and referenced on the agenda page. So Peter, why don't you start, you have some slides, maybe talk a little bit about some recent developments, what you're working on, what you will be working on. And then I'm sure the group will have questions about, you know, what does the model say about X or Y and so on. And whatever. So Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. Happy to give an update. We've been working on two kinds of things. One is responding to public comments and trying to talk through questions that people have and to do updates in response to those questions. And as Charlie said, we posted an addendum to the main report, which is available on the university faculty webpage and also through a link on my webpage. And that looks at a number of questions, you know, that people asked. A lot of them focusing on the number of contacts per day and focusing on different ways to think about the comparison between residential instruction and virtual instruction. So you can look at that addendum in order to understand just all of those details. And then the other kind of thing that we've been doing is making detailed preparations so that we can really try to achieve just the maximum level of safety that we can as students arrive, understanding that it's a difficult mission. And so that involves, you know, detailed design of the gateway testing protocol that I'll talk about in a moment, and detailed design of the asymptomatic screening protocol, things like what sampling method you use, targeted testing to different individuals on campus based on equity, based on vulnerability, based on our beliefs, which are very, you know, unfortunately quite imperfect about transmission rates among those individuals, and also between, you know, for example, between students in different, you know, housing conditions, between students and staff, students and faculty, different types of faculty, different types of staff. So those two kinds of things, and those things have been complicated by conditions that are changing on the ground. I've gotten a lot of questions about the rising, or, you know, the fact that prevalence in the United States during the month of June, according to confirmed case counts, and presumably also according to, you know, once you adjust for underreporting bias, are much larger than they were, you know, much larger in July than in June. And then the same thing is true for Tompkins County. So thinking about that, yes, think about President Pollack's recent announcement that we changed the way that we're thinking about, you know, change the policy about students who would need to self-quarantine from states that are on New York State's list of high prevalence states. So adjusting our analyses in order to cope with those, and then also responding to questions from Assemblywoman Lifton. So yeah, let's jump in. Maybe that's kind of just an overview of what we're doing. Let's jump into the first slide here. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about how we are thinking about the recent changes in prevalence. It's important to distinguish between what is happening here in Ithaca and in the area surrounding Ithaca and Tompkins County, you know, and surrounding communities. It's important to distinguish that from what is happening in, for example, Florida or Arizona or Texas, because obviously, you know, we're here, we care about what happens here, and the things that happen afar, those affect us in a very different way. They affect us through travel. So what I'm showing here is a graph of something that I'm sure a lot of us now spend a lot of time with, the daily data from Tompkins County Health Department, showing the number of new cases. What I'm showing is the daily count of new confirmed cases starting from July 1. So that goes up until the latest data point was last night. And so what you see is you see, you know, basically zeros through early July, just like, you know, a lot of zeros in June. And then you see a bump, a scary bump up to 10 on July 14th. And then you see a gradual decline, you know, that I hope continues. So the other piece of data that I'll convey to you that I think is meaningful is that Tompkins County Health Department published a report on July 21 at the request of the legislature, which talked about demographic information about these cases. And in particular, I'll call your attention to the fact that 16 out of the 31 cases that were discussed in that report, you know, which included the period from July 1st through July 21st, had known relevant travel and presumably were infected externally to Tompkins County through that travel. We don't know the percentage of cases with travel after that date. That hasn't been reported. We're in conversations with the health department and trying to get data that can help improve the quality of our decisions while also respecting privacy. So the, you know, 16 out of 31 is basically, you know, a little more than half. And That suggests to me, so a high percentage of cases with travel during July 1st through 21st, plus the gradual decline afterward, suggests that the local average R-naught in July, especially in that period, you know, kind of after the data, is less than one. So R-naught is epidemiological measure that counts how many new infections are started by each source case. If that number is bigger than one, then what happens is that you get exponential growth in the total number of cases. And then as long as your reporting bias isn't too bad, which Tompkins County has very good test access compared to at least the rest of the US, you would see exponential growth in those confirmed case counts. And I think one can, I think the data is pretty strongly suggestive that that's not going on. So that suggests that local R-naught is less than one. You can use this data to try to get an estimate of what local R-naught is by summing, you need to make assumptions about how many of the cases that happen after July 21 were exported from the outside, but under if you assume that that's zero, which is the pessimistic assumption, then you get a local R-naught of around 3/4. Another thing that you might draw from this data is a time varying transmission rate that may be due to parties around the 4th of July. That's also something. So I think this data suggests that number one, there's a significant risk of travel to high prevalence regions of the US. And number two, there's a significant risk associated with large scale social gatherings. But it is suggestive that that this local R-naught is less than one. So in terms of what that actually means in terms of outlook and in terms of what we should be doing, it indicates that gateway testing is really, really, really important because we're going to be having students arrive from these regions, and we need to make sure that the cases that they're importing as much as humanly possible are caught before they infect other people in the community. It's encouraging that, in spite of the fact that we don't have regular asymptomatic screening, we do have screening of students that's happening, I believe, twice a week. And we've seen Gary Koretsky sent an email describing results from those tests, I believe on July 31st, where we've done a few thousand tests and the prevalence among those tests is, among the students, is about 0.1%. So those things I think are encouraging, but at the same time, it's important that we expect and plan for local R0 to rise as students return and they engage in activities on campus and there's more contact with each other. So we need to be ready for that. And that's why we really are depending on the asymptomatic screening and the behavioral compact to both catch cases when they happen and also to reduce transmission from its organic value. Let's go to the next slide here. So gateway testing is critical, and we have a report analyzing gateway testing that one of the members of the modeling team is working on night and day, including last night, and is working on now. And we're gonna post that by midnight. And so what this does is it analyzes our gateway testing procedure. And we've had to modify this, in light of changing national prevalence, the fact that students from high prevalence states who unfortunately are not able to find housing locally in order to quarantine, in order to understand the impact of that on health outcomes. And also, you know, a quarantine capacity. I'm not showing you results for quarantine capacity here, but that's also also important. So the modeling timeline is that we ask students to be tested at home. We are not expecting all students to be able to be tested at home. We're assuming that students in high prevalence states, part of the reason that those, you know, there's like a, students from high prevalence states tend to have less access to testing, both because the reason that they're high prevalence is because public health didn't have as good test access, but also because when cases rise, you have the local population using a larger number of tests. And so those two things are end up resulting in having less test access in those states. So we assume partial compliance with that. And we also assume false negative rates, you know, associated with PCR-based testing. So we assume 30% of cases from high prevalence states and 60% from low prevalence states will be caught before departure by students using that at-home testing. Then we assume that most students who are arriving from high prevalence states, but not all, who have an ability to quarantine according to New York State law, will arrive in time to comply with that law. They will be tested when they arrive through test sites that were operating during that time period. The positives will be isolated, and that way we'll be able to monitor the behavior of those known positives more closely. Negatives will still be required to self-quarantine by state law, and we assume 60% compliance with that state law. Then during move-in weekend, 2 weeks later, students from low prevalence states and then also some non-compliant students from high prevalence states that we think may, you know, skirt around the law will arrive. We will test them, and then again, positives will be isolated. And also, you know, close contacts, of which hopefully there will be few, will be quarantined. Then then the semester will start. The regular asymptomatic screening program will begin. That will be, although in our June 15th report, that is a one-size-fits-all screening policy. In practice, we find substantial value from targeted testing, where students, where individuals in basically in higher risk groups are tested more frequently. The sampling method, we are still determining which method we will use. It will either be only nasopharyngeal, or it will be paired nasopharyngeal and anterior nares. And so the impact, so here what we do in the modeling, in the report we break this out, but just kind of combining it together is the most important number. So this is the number of infections during the period that I just discussed, plus 18 days after, you know, which is roughly when we, you know, you import some cases and then you miss some through testing. And, you know, and because some were exposed during transit and their viral loads are low, so there's this kind of wave that comes in. And then as long as local R0 is less than one, the wave dissipates. And so we're looking, you know, so it's important to look at the time chunk, not just right at move-in weekend, but also afterward. So if students return, we see 310 and this is not including Greater Ithaca. We have another analysis we're working on Greater Ithaca that we're hoping to get out as soon as we can. But among the Cornell community, so students who are returning, students who are already here, staff and faculty, approximately 310 infections. Understanding that, you know, with all modeling, we have a lot of uncertainty due to assumptions and also just significant uncertainty about inputs. We also look at another scenario, which we don't view as realistic, but we think offers a, you know, like a meaningful baseline, you know, that you can use for comparison. So the baseline that we look at here is if we could somehow prevent all students who are not in Ithaca from returning, you know, and again, you know, we don't view that as feasible based on the indication that many students would return to Ithaca for virtual instruction, even if we ask them not to, but just using that as a baseline. So you have, you know, those infections 310 infections include students that were infected at home. You know, they're coming from Texas and they are asymptomatic. They think that they're not sick. They weren't able to get a test at home because that's not offered in their area, or it's reserved for symptomatic individuals. So, you know, those people are going to be sick whether or not they come to Cornell, and that they number 195. Then you also have infections that would have happened in Ithaca regardless of students returning, just because of other travel that people are doing to other areas. It's important to note that when you look at the TCHD numbers, or really any numbers for confirmed case counts, you really need to multiply that by some underreporting bias. CDC has estimates where that number, you know, can be as high as 10x in some areas. I don't think it's as high as that in Tompkins County, but you know, when thinking about that 55 number relative to what we saw, you know, in July, you know, should help to calibrate that. So in this scenario where we're able to prevent all students from returning, we see 250 infections during that time period in the population. Whereas if they do return, we see an increase of 60 infections for 310 total infections. It's also worth noting that this analysis does not include the impact on the families of the students. If, you know, if you have an individual who is not able to come to Ithaca, in some cases, those students would be living alone. But in many cases, those students would be living with family members. And presumably, if they were sick, then you'd have a higher risk of infection for those family members, which can be problematic, especially because while when students are interacting with each other, mostly here in Ithaca, the age of the individual that an infected person is interacting with tends to be, you know, tends to be a young age. When you're interacting with family members, particularly in an intergenerational household, you tend to be interacting with older people, for which the severity of the disease tends to be significantly larger. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So yeah, it just kind of other things that we are doing that I briefly sketched at the top. So we released this addendum. The link is there in the, you know, and you can have access to these slides, and you can also find it, for example, if you go to the university faculty webpage, you find the link there. Designing targeted testing policies, so exactly like, you know, who's going to be tested at what frequency, and trying to respect, you know, kind of physical constraints about how many people we can test, but also trying to use that test capacity as well as we can. Looking at adaptive testing so this would be, for example, what do we do if we find a case on a dorm floor, or a cluster of cases on a dorm floor? You know, are there kind of interventions that we could do that would help to nip that cluster in the bud? Looking at the impact on the greater Ithaca area, I'll mention that even though so kind of the net effect of this is actually optimistic. In the June 15th report, we assumed a relatively large rate of outside infections from Greater Ithaca, and upon further analysis, where we actually like model infections in Greater Ithaca based on data that we see over the summer, we see actually that number was probably too pessimistic. So that ends up helping, and you know, and improves health outcomes a bit. And we see, you know, in terms of comparisons between the residential instruction scenario and the virtual instruction scenario, we see the same ordering in terms of health outcomes for the, you know, on Greater Ithaca, excluding the Cornell community, as we do for the Cornell community. Essentially what happens is that if you're unable to ensure significant compliance with testing, or you have, you know, some fraction of students who are never tested, as we expect would happen in the virtual instruction scenario. And as a result, you have a large cluster of cases that grow in that population. Then because they have some interaction with non-student population in Ithaca, that ends up creating negative health consequences for non-individuals in Ithaca. And then also something that's really important is just thinking through all of the, you know, we have a lot of uncertainty and we need to be prepared for that. So designing scenarios for Gary Koretsky to be discussed with President Pollack about, you know, from small, you know, a single case in a dorm, you know, too big, you know, we see, you know, based on estimates of R-naught in the student population, we think that our, you know, that epidemic is growing out of control, and, you know, what would be the conditions under which we would need to issue, you know, we would recommend a shelter in place or an evacuation. So thinking through, you know, and hopefully we don't need that, but it's much better to think that through before, when you have time and, you know, and you can analyze things. Much better to think that through early than to wait until you really need it. So yeah, that's kind of what we're doing, and I hope that was helpful.
Okay, thank you, Peter. So we have time here for several or multiple questions. So the chat line has been very busy. Perhaps somebody who posted something there would verbalize their concern or their question.
Do we get Ken Berman?
Sure. So first of all, Peter, thank you for all of this work and for the careful report. And everybody tremendously appreciates how hard you're working on this and what you've done. It strikes me that what you've developed is very model sensitive, and that part of the model is this agreement that we have with the students that they're going to behave properly. My question on the chat line was, what do we do if we notice students having large parties in College Town? A number of us live there. My question to you would be, how sensitive are these models to that type of assumption? And how large a deviation from correct behavior can we tolerate before your predictions stop being accurate? I mean, you don't really know, but where you would start to know that they're not accurate.
We have done, so the relevant number there would be the two things that are really equivalent, which is the rate of contacts per day or the transmission rate. And we have, you know, we have two different kinds of models. We have the models that we've published in the addendum and in the main report, which assume a homogeneous population. And what we see there is that as long as you have the ability to increase the frequency of testing, you know, the number of contacts per day can you know, the amount of transmission on average across the Cornell community, you know, can be increased pretty large without seeing a significant negative health outcome. As long as, number one, you notice it. And we should be able to notice it because we should be able to notice it because we're going to be looking at all this testing data, you know. But then, like, we need to do a good job of like, you know, and we're setting this up, but like looking at the data and making sure that we're seeing it, and then we need to be able to intervene. And I think there are two kinds of ways that we can intervene. One is to increase the test frequency, and I think we'll probably, and this is the work we're doing for these scenarios, recommend doing both. So one is to increase the frequency of testing for the population that seems to have elevated transmission. The other thing that you should do is put in, you know, you should put in extra effort towards behavioral modifications to try to ensure that that kind of transmission doesn't actually happen. I would, you know, and I think there are a lot of things that you could do. For example, you could hire extra, you know, people to go around and make sure that students aren't having large, loud parties in College Town.
So, Peter, can I ask a question? Yeah. So, College Town and also the sororities and the frats,
yep,
would appear to be obvious candidates for increased. Are you modeling a situation where you assume that there's a lot of contact occurring there, and right from the start, we're aggressively over-adjusting there?
Yeah, we do. So that's not in the addendum or the June 15th report, but that's in this targeted testing report that we're using in order to design the in order to design the actual testing frequencies that we're using. So in that report, we break up the Cornell, we break up the student population into several different groups. So we have undergraduates who are living in high density housing, and we're modeling those individuals as having the highest rate of transmission due to their, you know, living arrangements. And so that would include, that includes people living in residence halls and includes people living in sorority and fraternity houses. Then we have undergraduates who are living in lower density housing off campus. We model them as having a larger amount of transmission because number one, yeah, intuition about parties. And number two, the literature supports that younger individuals seem to have about 30% more contacts than kind of the general population. So we are planning to target testing more frequently to people in those groups. Yeah, and that's really important too, because if we see, you know, it's one thing if you see transmission elevated across the whole community, that means you need to ramp up, if the only response that you have is to ramp up testing, then that's like a lot of testing. So that's not necessarily easy. But if you see, if you're able to see in a more targeted way that certain, you know, that for example, only undergraduate students, even that would be a big win versus the entire population, or, you know, undergraduate students who are living in fraternity and sorority houses. And if you can do targeted interventions just for those individuals, then all of a sudden it's becoming something that's, you know, easier to execute on.
Wendy Wilcox and then Martin Kasabov. Wendy.
Hey, Peter. I want to ask, can you talk about what are some of the high risk environments that students would encounter on campus? So you're talking about living, you're talking about their classrooms, but what other things will they be engaging in that might be high risk?
Right. So, you know,
where I'm going with this.
I would include the library.
My concern. Like, have you done modeling around? Because we know the students want places to study. I've heard they want to be able to go back to Zeus and go into Goldwyn Smith. And have you looked at that modeling? Because that is this sort of unknown, and we know tons of people go into that. There's very little ability to trace who's visiting those spaces.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of different considerations. So, the library, and, you know, this is kind of obvious, right? Like, the library is a place where people are in, you know, kind of enclosed spaces, you know, and this does depend on the extent to which, we do have some control over this, but anytime that you have people in close spaces together, you know, and the CDC number is 6 feet or less, 15 minutes or more, but, you know, even further than that, you know, risk, it's not like risk is this and then drops to zero. It's, you know, it's kind of like that. So, yeah, closed spaces indoors, long periods of time. That would be associated with, transmission through the air. And then, you know, you also worry about surfaces. So transmission on surfaces. So, you know, an individual touches one thing and then somebody else comes along and touches that. So both of those are present in the library. There are other considerations too, like anytime people are drinking, that's bad because then they are more likely to not wear masks and they're probably more likely to forget that you shouldn't be like touching somebody or being super close to somebody. So any kind of environment where people are being, where alcohol is consumed, you know, we believe is dangerous. If we can get people to wear masks, that's always better. So that's a thing that can make restaurants more dangerous because, you know, it's hard, you can't wear a mask while you eat. Also being, you know, like something that's good about the library is that presumably people are not super loud in the library, and being really, you know, like yelling or singing is dangerous because that takes droplets from the respiratory tract and expels them into the air. So yeah, I mean, in answer to your question, we are modeling, you know, interaction of people on campus as a risk factor. We are not currently looking at the level of detail for, you know, this building versus that building. And we are instead relying on, because, you know, there's like a limit to what we can do. Like any kind of math model that we would build at that level of granularity, I think would tell you stuff that you already know. You know, it would be like, if you can keep people separate, then things are better. If you can make people wear masks, then things are better. And so those are things you already know, so you don't really need me to tell you that. And the numbers that we would report for the level of risk associated with this building, I think would be so sensitive to the number. Like, we don't really have a good way to calibrate those things. Like we, yeah. So, you know, happy to help with articulating kind of just things we know about the biology, if that can be helped. But I think it's probably too detailed for the modeling team to be able to do models.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Nima, you have your hand up, and then we want to go to Martin. Nima.
Peter, thank you for that. Just had a quick question that's been coming up a lot in various meetings that we've been having. So what's the exact threshold, if you can explain it to non-statisticians like myself, the exact kind of threshold at which the university will decide, you know, it's getting too dangerous, we need to shut down. So I, of course, live in one of those targeted areas, and yeah. Particular concern to faculty who have to interact a lot with students, right? How do we know this, and how do we, as you know, as the people on the ground, really keep track of it?
Right. So that's our job, to deliver to Gary by Friday and to give a preliminary version, and then to give that preliminary version to President Pollack early next week. So here's how we're currently thinking about it, is we have kind of existing early warning signs that are, just from like standard epidemiology, like you can fit an exponential curve to, you look at how quickly the confirmed case counts are rising, and if it's rising really quickly, then that tells you kind of what R naught is. So one early warning sign will be based on that. Another one will be based on confirmed cases, even if R naught is, even if we see one individual infect five other individuals, but those are the only cases we see, so we think R naught is five, but we also have only seen six cases, we're probably gonna wait and see because it's still early yet. So a way to think about it is that there's this, you can form a rule where you come up with some estimates for R naught, I described one, and then there's another one that we're hoping to build based on the more detailed data that we're getting from the asymptomatic screening. You put those together, you need to think through, sometimes you'll see R naught be large, but maybe it's something that we can fix. Like, Ken talked about parties. Maybe we see in the first week, we see a big party and it's really bad, but then we decide, we have a pretty good intervention that we can go and we can really, we feel that we didn't want to do it before, but now we see it's necessary. And so we put that in place. So that's kind of like phase one. But then you get to a point where both your R naught is above one, significantly above one, and you feel like you've done a reasonable set of things in order to try to get it below one. And at that point in time, what you should do is, what you talked about, either shelter in place or send people home. Now the exact, I don't know how President Pollack is going to think about whether she wants to have an exact set of numerical values, or she simply wants to have a, you know, a robust kind of decision-making process with a set of metrics and a way to think about those metrics. I don't know. That's a difficult decision. But yeah, that's kind of this, that's going to be the substance of our advice.
Okay. Thank you. I hope, can you stay after 5 o'clock, Peter?
I can. Let me make sure. Yeah, I think so. I set that up so that I could do it. Sorry. Yes.
Okay, great. Those of you who have to leave, that's absolutely okay. Remember, everything is going, the audio will be up there by tomorrow morning or so. So let's continue here. Martin Casabot had a question.
I have a quick question. One of the figures in the model suggests that, like, you believe that you can control the spread even if there's a very large number of, like, contacts per person, which corresponds to are not of the order of, like, 8, 9, or 10. And the only way I can explain this thing is that you're assuming that there is no delay between testing people and quarantining them. And in fact, there is going to be some delay because you need to process the tests and so on. So how this thing is going to affect the model?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. It is true that one of the assumptions that we're making is that there's no delay in the testing, that there's no delay between the test result, between the sample being collected and the person who's positive being isolated.
But the way that going to get delay of at least a day. There is no way to avoid that. You process the test, like, you cannot do it like in 5 minutes.
Right, indeed. So we are very lucky in that we will be doing the testing locally. We will be doing it in the vet school and at CMC, and exactly what, you know, who gets, which samples get processed where is being aligned on. But yeah, the guarantee that they've given is that you'll get the test result. So we're doing pooled testing, pools in size 5. So you'll get your, you know, you get your sample taken. The result will then go to the vet school. I think that's going to be most of the tests. So up on Tower Road, and they will do PCR. They will pool it with 4 other individuals. They will do PCR. They will get you the test result for your pool within 24 hours. If you're in a pool that tests positive, then you will be required to quarantine while they do a second swab and send that out for a diagnostic test. That's an FDA requirement associated with the way that we have set up regulatory around pool testing. And so the key, and then, you know, if you test negative on that diagnostic swab, then you can go. But if you test positive, then you need to isolate, and then hopefully you're okay.
Sure, but there will be a spread inside this 24-hour period. And right. If R0 is like very big, like you cannot control it.
Right. Yeah, so there are, you know, so that is an assumption. That is one of the assumptions that we're making that is more optimistic than reality. The way that I think about it is, I think about it in 2 different ways. So one is that you can look at the results from a sensitivity analysis. One way to look at this is that you can look at the test results from sensitivity analysis for a larger, a smaller fraction of the population that's being tested per day. And that will be somewhat representative of what we would expect from the, you know, if we were able to run the simulation with a test delay. That's one way to think about it is, you know, and when you look at that, you know, we show the sensitivity analysis up to a very large number of contacts. You know, if R0 is 8 or 10 on average across the Cornell community, then yeah, I'm not confident that we would be able to handle, you know, an R0 of 10. You know, and we try to do everything we can in order to model uncertainty, but that would be just like a really extreme.
Sure, like it's clear that like nobody can handle like R naught of like more than five. That's completely insane. Like to think that you can control it.
But right. like but there's no, you know. And then the other thing, the way that I think about it is that that's one of the assumptions that makes our model too optimistic. There are a number of assumptions that make our model too pessimistic. One of them is that we assume that contacts are well mixed with each other, whereas in reality, individuals tend to interact with each other within their social networks, and an infection can't jump from one part of the network to a totally distant part of the network immediately. It takes some time. And that kind of effect tends to reduce the growth of outbreaks, and we're not modeling that.
That's
another thing.
Excuse me. I want to get to other questions. Martin.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. Paul Ginsberg.
Hi, Peter.
Hey,
so there, I apologize. A lot of this stuff is still in progress, I understand. And even this comment you just made about the pools of size five and the required reswabbing was news to me. We heard yesterday that the surveillance testing on students will be done via the front of the nostril swabbing. And I looked up, I couldn't actually find, you know, data on the false negative rate for that. So I'll just go through all the questions. So the first question I had is, where does that fall within your sensitivity analysis? The second question is, the same message from the provost said that students would be tested either once or twice a week. And I recall, I forget if this is something you told me, it was probably in your report, that the simulations were very sensitive to the assumption that everybody on campus would be tested every 5 days. I think if you went up even just to 7 days, it was a 41% increase in the number of cases or something like that. So I'm wondering how this uncertainty in the once or twice a week will affect those sorts of estimates. And then the final thing that came up from a few people on chat were confused about how often faculty and staff will be tested, where will we be tested, and what test will we be given? Will it be deep nasal or the anterior nares?
Uh-huh. Okay, great. Yeah, all great questions. So false negative rate for anterior nares, I'll send you some papers. The number that we changed the sensitivity. So in the targeted testing analysis that we're doing in order to make the decisions about test frequency, we model a sensitivity of 60% for the asymptomatic screening. That was based on, that's a pessimistic estimate that came out of, there's data, most of the data tends to come from people who are in hospital, and those individuals tend to have higher viral loads. So those data compare sensitivity of anterior nares versus nasopharyngeal. They find that it's better than 60%, but we use the 60% number because we wanted to model lower viral load individuals. For the asymptomatic screening that we have been doing, and also CMC has been doing in the mall, for some fraction of the cases, they take an NP swab and an AN swab. So we have these dual samples, really awesome for asymptomatic, you know, and so CMCs, you know, those individuals, a lot of them are symptomatic, but for the gateway testing that we're doing, those are asymptomatic individuals. So it seems from that data, the N is small still, but the number that Gary is quoting to me is more like a sensitivity of 70%, something like that. So it seems like we're okay there. In terms of Mike's email about 1x or 2x per week, there's not, the reason he said that is because we're segmenting students into groups, and I'm not sure it's been officially decided the frequencies for different groups, so I don't wanna like say something that is not my decision to make, but in our targeted testing, one of the testing sets of testing frequencies that performs well and fits within our testing budget, you know, like how many tests we can do per day logistically, is that we would test graduate students who are primarily research-based once a week, and then we would test other students twice a week. And then there's some, and then there's also some thinking about doctor of veterinary medicine, even though those are primarily doing research, those individuals also, you know, need to interact really frequently with each other. So there's some details around that. So I think the reason that he said one or two is not because he doesn't know, or not that we won't know when we do it. It's that he probably didn't want to get into that level of detail. How often will faculty and staff be tested? Again, I don't want to like set in stone something that I can't set in stone, but we are looking at testing. I believe we were looking, this recommended protocol, I think, is testing faculty and staff who are on campus once a week, and then faculty and staff who are off campus and promise to never come to campus basically once a month. Where will those faculty be tested? I would defer to someone else on that. And the test, you know, I mean, faculty who are off campus, I am hoping that we can set up something so that they don't need to come to campus in order to be tested. That would be counterproductive in my view. And then for the sampling method, yeah, the asymptomatic screening will be anterior nares. So you don't need to worry about having a thing go up your nose. Yeah, too far.
Let's get on to Ailong Ki, please, your question.
Yeah, so actually Paul just asked my question, almost the same question. I mean, the false positive rate could affect the model outcome. And the experience of the tester, like the people who take the sample, could also affect it. Like if the experience varies, your model could you know have a large error rate because of that.
Yeah.
The robustness of the testing method is relevant in this case.
Definitely. You're worried, but you're asking about false positives rather than false
negatives. False negatives. False negative. If we miss a lot of cases, then it's going to be.
Just to comment, the video from BU, which is also using the anterior nares, actually showed the students themselves would be doing that.
Yes. So this is being nailed down, but my understanding is that the current proposal is that it'll be observed, self-collected anterior nares. So the student would collect it themselves, but would be, and I believe the same thing for faculty and staff, you know, all individuals would collect it themselves, but would be observed by someone who knows what they're doing. And that's part of the reason that we use this pessimistic sensitivity, you know, in order to model, you know, lack of experience in doing that kind of sample collection.
Okay, thanks. Let's make this the last question, remembering again that there's a chat line and that we can always forward things to Peter afterwards. Chris.
Hi, Peter. Chris Schaefer from Biomedical Engineering. Thank you so much to you and your team for all of this careful modeling work. It really does give some serious confidence in the plans that the university is putting out. I really had one question and one suggestion. So first, the suggestion, in terms of the timing of testing for faculty, it might be useful to provide some nuanced guidance, asking faculty to assess the degree that they are being exposed. For example, I know I'm going to be teaching a lab class that's going to be split across four sections, spread throughout the week with a modest number of students in each of them. Given that, it seems like testing me is epidemiologically very important. Yes. At a high frequency. So I would encourage some nuance in that guidance and the ability to elect to test more frequently. The second question I have, so that was the comment. The question is about the revision to the quarantine policy that Cornell has made. I have deep concerns about about inequities that are going to be caused by this. Essentially, if you can buy out an expensive hotel room for 2 weeks, then you can come back. If you can't afford that, then you're left on your own. I know that there was some discussion about Cornell getting an exception to the two-week quarantine policy based on the incoming testing. And I assume that there was an effort to negotiate that at the highest levels. The science seems sound. I'm curious to know, to hear your perspective on why that wasn't permitted.
Yeah, I agree with all that. Yes, there was a request made at the highest level, you know, to the highest level in order to get an exception made so that we didn't face that really difficult decision that unfortunately, I think has bad consequences.
Am I correct in the assumption that the testing, the isolation testing regime that you've implemented obviates?
Yeah, it would have been fine.
For quarantine, yeah.
Yeah, it would have been fine, in my view. And, the answer was no. I don't really know. I don't have details into, like, why the answer from the state was no.
Probably they don't want to get into the business of making exceptions.
Yes, that would be a reasonable speculation. Yeah, but I don't know.
Okay, so first of all, thank you, Peter, for coming and answering these questions. And I'll make sure you get to see all the additional questions on the chat line.
Great, thanks, Charlie.
And at high level, thank you. I think your group has been really a model for transparency and being receptive to questions and then acting on them. I think that you to be highly commended for that. And we all appreciate that so very much. Okay, so this is the end of the meeting, but as you know, after Jill turns off the recording, we all go out into the hall and say what we really think. No. So anyway, thank you for coming. Pay attention to your email. You'll get something from me early tomorrow with follow-up. And remember, there is a town hall tomorrow with the provost and then the leaders of several of the critical implementation teams. And I'm also going to send them the gist of what came up this afternoon with us. So again, thank you very much. And the meeting is now officially over, but Nima and I sort of hang around and are happy to talk to people.